Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drewer, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss the decision handed down on April 14th in Axon Enterprise Incorporated v. Federal Trade Commission. It's my honor to introduce our guests today. We're joined by Ronald Cass and Henry Sue. Ronald Cass is Dean Emeritus of Boston University Law School, where he was dean from 1990 to 2004. He's also a former vice chairman and commissioner of the U.S. International Trade Commission and is now president of Cass & Associates PC, a legal consultancy. And Henry Sue is a trial lawyer who worked for the FTC from 2011 to 2017 and specialized in antitrust law. And we're very happy to have both of them join us today to talk about Axon. So I guess to start us off, can we talk briefly about the background of the case and the significance of the case, why our listeners should care about how the decision came down before we get into the decision itself?
Well, the case is actually a combination of two cases, one which comes out of a dispute over SEC enforcement of the Securities and Exchange Commission's regulations, and the other, which is the Axon case, which comes out of a dispute over the Federal Trade Commission's enforcement of provisions under its aegis. And the two are combined because they both raise a question of whether someone can go to court without waiting for the end of a decision at the agency by the agency's decision maker on adjudications, whether it can go to court and seek resolution of a complaint about the agency decision-making process before that.
Yeah, I'll just add that, you know, specifically what both Michelle Cochran and Axon Enterprises wanted to do was to raise, you know, complaints about the constitutionality of the agency decision-making process. Again, you know, without having to wait for the agency to finish that process and to reach a final decision that could be appealed, they wanted to challenge, you know, that process in federal district court. And what you have with these two cases are two different results from the courts of appeals, which is what created the question for the Supreme Court to take up.
So I guess transitioning to the decision, I know we normally ask, you know, if there was anything surprising about how the votes shook out, but in this case, being a unanimous decision, I was wondering if you all could kind of unpack the reasoning behind the decision, and if you all were surprised by its unanimity, you know, feel free to expand on that a little bit.
Well, I will say that unanimity is actually the most common result at the Supreme Court. It's not the most common result in cases that we spend a lot of time talking about. But the unanimity here isn't so surprising when you see the different ways people got there. But it is important to note that while the decision is unanimous, the way the justices think about it is not. And let me stop in case Henry wants to jump in on that before going to the what happened and so what.
No, thank you, Professor Cass. I agree. I mean, you know, in this case, I see this question as purely a procedural question about whether one has to wait till, you know, the agency decision-making process is completed before raising a challenge to the constitutionality of the process. And so the unanimity is simply a reflection that no, you don't have to wait. And I don't think there was any doubt in my mind that that's how the Supreme Court would end up. But what's more interesting is sort of how the different members of the court analyze that question, and specifically these two concurring opinions from Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas.
I think that that's exactly right. I agree with Henry that the way they get there is what's interesting. And for the majority, they look back to a case decided back in 1994, the Thunder Basin case, and they look at the factors that informed the decision there, which were basically three factors. They asked, would denying relief in this context, would denying the ability to sue in this context, essentially foreclose meaningful review of the claim that was being made? And as Henry said, the claim in each case here is that the process was unconstitutional because the decision maker was unconstitutionally appointed or wasn't sufficiently controlled by the president. The second question the Thunder Basin case looked at was the claim that was being made, that was being brought to court, really integrally related to the decision that would be made by the agency, or was it really collateral to the decision by the agency? And then last, the question was, did the question that was being argued in court draw on agency expertise, or did it not draw on agency expertise? And the majority, the opinion, the opinion for the court by Justice Kagan, looked at those factors and decided that all three factors militated in favor of taking the case through the district court the way that the plaintiffs in these cases sought to bring it to the court's attention. And then we pause there before we get to what Justices Thomas and Gorsuch had to say.
Yeah, no, I would just add that, you know, the reason this Thunder Basin framework that the majority goes through exists because, you know, in the early 20th century, with the creation of, or the expansion of the administrative state, if you will, you have this scheme where agencies have their own adjudicative authority. And the scheme is such that, you know, you let the agency adjudicate, and then you then allow the litigants to appeal to the Court of Appeals, but it's on a much more limited basis where they're giving deference, you know, in what the agency did in its adjudication. And that's the scheme. And so the question that, you know, kind of arises in the context of Thunder Basin is, okay, given that this is the scheme we have, should we let these kinds of claims that Ms. Cochran and Axon are raising go through that scheme and then ultimately be reviewed by a court of appeals and you know, ultimately by the Supreme Court? Or do we, you know, kind of take it out of that scheme and allow a federal district court to separately address it, you know, in parallel with the agency adjudicative process?
And in this context, Justice Gorsuch goes directly at that question by saying that you have a law in the books that allows general federal question jurisdiction, 28 U.S.C. 1331. And he said, it's clear that since it allows federal jurisdiction generally, these cases ought to go forward unless there's something that very specifically and clearly says they can't. And he looks at the provisions that are relied on by the agencies in both cases and said those simply aren't clear enough, direct enough contradictions of the general federal question jurisdiction. So for him, he would resolve the question that the rest of the justices are resolving. He'd just do it in a different way. Justice Thomas says the more important question here is, are these the sort of cases that should be before agencies at all? for them to adjudicate. And I think that's a bigger question. It's a very important question. And the fact that he's asking it here tells you something about why this case is getting attention, because there has been a lot of action in the court over the last 5 years or so on questions of what the separation of powers really means, how it really has to play out, and what administrative agencies ought to be able to do in a scheme that was set up to have the judiciary, the executive branch, and the Congress, and nothing that looked like it was perhaps lopping over into somebody else's domain. And that's the question that keeps coming up. It's interesting that you get unanimity here, because the justices certainly are not unanimous on that bigger, broader question.
And I would just add to what Professor Cass has said, kind of starting with his last point. I agree that the justices don't, you know, agree on kind of what, you know, what the concerns are with the, you know, the way the administrative state has become and what, you know, what the proper role is under our Constitution, you know, given the separation of powers and the three branches, you know, and the administrative state is simply being this fourth branch. It's not really explicitly addressed. But obviously that's a question for another day, right? So Axon is just about whether those questions can be teed up somewhere by, and, you know, in front of what forum. But, you know, it's for another day what arguments litigants like Axon or Ms. Crockin will make to a federal district court about the constitutionality of, you know, agency decision making. The other things I will add are that, you know, I think Justice Gorsuch basically says the command, it's really a command under, you know, 28 U.S.C. 1331. It says that the district court shall have original jurisdiction over these types of claims. And so the point is there's just nothing else that the agencies were pointing to in the statutory text that, you know, makes clear that command has somehow been changed by Congress. There's nothing there. And then I agree that Justice Thomas, he's raising the broader question again of, you know, the expansion of agency, you know, adjudicative power in the 20th century. And so he has broader concerns that, you know, are abundant in his opinion, right? But again, those, whether litigants pursue those arguments, that's for another day.
I'd also agree with Henry, but I'd also say that one of the things that's going to make this case a case people will talk about, even though the actual decision is narrow, is that it connects to a lot of other sorts of doctrines and questions. So, for instance, the question, can you hear this case now, also connects to questions about staying agency decisions. What sort of harm is there from letting an agency decision go into effect before it can be reviewed in court? What sort of issues ought courts to be thinking about? And there's a lot of attention in all of the opinions to the potential harm to people from allowing agency proceedings to have effect before they can be reviewed. Another connection here is to the way the court is starting to approach things. Justice Kagan, who writes for the court here, wrote a decision in Kaiser v. Wilkie, which looked at what was known as the Auer Doctrine, where there's deference to agency review and construction of ambiguous agency rules. And what Kagan's opinion, Justice Kagan's opinion does in the Kaiser case is to rewrite the doctrine completely, to add all sorts of restrictions there, requirements for it, that are referred to in other cases, in other decisions, but were never part of that doctrine. And the doctrine is then repackaged with a lot of additional bells and whistles and a lot of additional considerations. Well, what you have in the Thunder Basin approach is a lot of considerations, a lot of different things that courts can look at. And it gives both a little more uncertainty to the outcome and a little more potential cover for still deferring to administrative agency decisions. And I think the fact that she was the person selected to write this shows at least comfort among some of the justices with that continuing approach to deciding these cases. It doesn't have to be a majority approach in a lot of other cases yet to come.
All right. Thank you all for breaking that down. So I guess you all touched on it slightly about the implications of the decision going forward. So I actually more than slightly. So I think I definitely love to hear more about implications going forward if there are any. But if you think that you've covered that, then I guess we can kind of round out the episode by inviting any additional thoughts that you have or anything that you see fit to cover.
Well, the one thing I would note here is that there are a lot of balls in the air right now on separation of powers questions. There's a question whether the non-delegation doctrine will come back. That was addressed in the Gundy case when Justice Kavanaugh was not yet participating in cases. And when you had one justice, Justice Alito, saying, this is an important question that I'd be happy to revisit in an appropriate case. He had written on it separately in a prior case where he said, this is an important issue for us to address. I think he has pretty clearly signaled openness to reviving it in some form. It was also something that was touched on in the major questions doctrine with respect to other recent decisions where in the West Virginia case in particular, the court is requiring a bigger, stronger, clearer message from Congress as to what sort of scope agencies are being given. There are lots of things that tuck into this, as well as what is the required extent of presidential control of subordinate officers in particular cases. What is it in the rulemaking context? What is it in the adjudication context? I think you have a lot of those things that you have threads that can be taken from this case and pulled in to future decisions, but it doesn't foreclose results on any of those margins. And I think that's part of what makes it such an interesting case.
Yeah, I would add that, you know, it is a recent case on which the court has taken cert. I think Loper Bright Enterprises is the case in which the court is willing to take up the question of whether the Chevron doctrine, right, which gives deference to agency decisions, would be retained or modified in some respect. So again, you know, I agree with Professor Cass that the significance of the Axon decision is that there is a forum. There is a forum for these concerns to be aired in the district courts, with the idea that it is there's a well-developed pathway to get these questions ultimately up to the Supreme Court. And so you have to look at Axon in conjunction with all the other cases that the court has addressed on, you know, relating to, you know, the scope of administrative, adjudicative powers and the appropriate allocation of, you know, responsibilities between, you know, the Article I branch of Congress and the Article II branch of the presidency in terms of, you know, the creation of these regulatory bodies. And so we, you know, that's kind of how I that's my takeaway about the Axon decision.
Is there anything else you all would like to touch on, or any kind of closing thoughts you'd like to give? Or I think that was a well done unpacking. So no worries if not.
Professor Cass, I'm always interested in your insights. If you have anything else you want to add.
Well, I do think that this is just one of a series of cases that are going to be unpacking different dimensions of a separation of powers doctrine that had kind of turned away from its historical roots and had turned away from that in stages over about an 80-year period. And now it has seemed to be evolving back closer to what it was beforehand, whether it's in the non-delegation space where you had in the late 1920s a turn away from prior law that then turned even more sharply away after that, or whether it's in the standard of review space where, as Henry mentioned, the Loper-Bright case is coming along. And there are different ways of looking at that. One is whether the Chevron doctrine should be viewed as something that is really just a restatement of the factors that are in the Administrative Procedure Act, Section 706, even though that wasn't the actual act at issue in Chevron. The Clean Air Act, which was at issue in Chevron, had a review provision that was really modeled after the APA Section 706. So it's effectively a question whether it should be read as merely restating that, or whether it's a separate doctrine. If it's a separate doctrine, what role should it have, if any? Should the court simply say, we didn't mean what a lot of people thought we meant there? Chevron, of course, doesn't matter that much to Supreme Court decisions. It hasn't been invoked by the court in years. But it matters to a lot of Court of Appeals decisions. So I think there are a lot of different issues that will come back to the court over the next several years that will show us where the court is headed on many of these separation of powers issues.
Yeah, and I think what I would add to that is remember that, you know, in these decisions, the Supreme Court is essentially discharging its responsibility as the ultimate, you know, body to tell the lower courts how to do things, right? And that's what Thunder Basin is. Thunder Basin is a recipe for lower courts to figure out how to evaluate a question like this. And so I think part of the court's willingness to take up these questions is seeing, you know, its role to say, well, you know, the lower courts are going to be encountering these types of questions from litigants, and how best should they do that? You know, how best should they take those questions up? And so that's the opportunity.
All right. So I think that rounds out our episode. So thank you both for joining us and breaking down Axon.
Happy to do it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.